Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Adrian Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello.
And Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Ahoy, hoy.
Gentlemen, I want to start off with, there were two stories, space-related stories, which first one didn't get a lot of coverage because it was an unfortunate situation. That was one of the astronauts, who I don't know if it's been publicly named yet, but had to be evacuated from the International Space Station because of a medical issue. And we had a splashdown earlier in the week as they brought back the Dragon capsule. And everybody's, back on Earth and they're getting care.
Yeah, there's obviously they wanted to be very tiptoey about the nature of the medical emergency. But the four astronauts, this is the first time in 25 years that a crew's been recalled early over a medical issue. There aren't often ones. But did you guys read about the clue? The clue?
No.
Well, you see, they felt better after a little bit. And boy, look at that photo. That is a happy astronaut right there. That is somebody who's looking, it's almost a glow about her. Anyway, they were talking about how medical emergencies don't often happen in space. But in their case, they were really glad that they had an ultrasound machine.
Well, kidney stones.
Could be. They also said, we can handle any kind of difficult situation. But this was, quote, actually very, very good experience for the future of human spaceflight. I'm just saying.
You are suggesting that this astronaut got knocked up in space.
I certainly hope so. Of all the medical emergencies for a reason to come down to space, I feel like
that would be a big story, right?
Yeah.
Has anyone gotten knocked up in space before?
No. As a matter of fact, officially, nobody has copped to
doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Although there was one shuttle mission.
Timelines.
It was one, there was a newlywed couple that went up in the space shuttle like the week after they got married. But according to this Futurism article, medical professionals also use ultrasound for cancer screening, checking heart valves for leaks and clots. But they definitely went out of their way to say it really helped, quote. Of course, we don't have other big machines that we have here on planet Earth. We do try to make sure that everybody before we fly are really, really not prone to surprises, quote. But sometimes things happen and surprises happen and the team was ready. So who knows?
Well, that would be an interesting one. So when did they go up?
I don't know.
Because my question would be it would be nuts. If it is that, if we're going to walk down that.
I mean, look, how often do you get to speculate?
Well, yeah, that's my question is like, so it would be unlikely that she was knocked up before she went up, right? If they'd been up there for a minute.
I don't know how long they were up
there. I don't
know
how much we want to go down this path because you're dealing with people who are married and other things I don't know. And given the source of that headline, I'm hesitant to sort of say.
Oh, I mean, this is Page Six gossip rag in my book. To me, this is a soap opera, but maybe it's too close to being real humans to you. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I am friends with somebody who was on the second to last mission. So yes.
Okay. All right.
I'm sure we'll find out and I wish them well. I'm excited to see. I'm glad they came back. And it is, just a crazy, unusual situation where, you think about that, where you have to kind of, bring somebody back, in that, and glad they're going to come back.
Yeah. Well, four people all seem happy and healthy.
Yeah. What I think is kind of the bigger story I want to talk about is we've got Artemis.
What is the status of Artemis?
The rocket is on the pad. This is the Artemis 2 mission. Artemis 1 was unmanned, send the capsule up to see if it, you know, how it held up, came back. There were questions about the heat shield. There's been some debate of whether or not the heat shield was ready to handle the reentries. There was a press conference, and Jared Isaacman brought in an outside team of people to bring in and offer their opinions on it. And they came to the conclusion they felt very comfortable with the heat shield situation and ready to proceed with the mission. So now the SLS rocket, which we've joked about for years because it's massively expensive, extremely costly, may actually, though, finally be carrying astronauts into space. So they're planning, I think, within next 2 weeks. Let's go see what the Artemis timeline is.
So this is, they're just going to be swinging around the moon, right? But this will be the first time since the Apollo days that a human's been on the other side of the moon.
Yeah. So right now the tentative date is February 6th. It's not a firm date yet, but they put it on the pad. They're starting to do testing. We'll know when they start doing the fuel testing. And I think that this is going to be, they're doing what's called a free return. So basically they send it up. It'll loop around the moon, but it still hasn't escaped Earth gravity. So it'll be pulled back towards the Earth. And in that scenario, I think they're saying that this will be the farthest humans have ever gone from Earth. And maybe the fastest.
Wow. So. That's crazy. And so that whole round trip is what, 2.5 days?
Oh, this is going to be, I think, like a week or something.
Okay.
Next about the Artemis mission.
That's a hell of a road trip.
And again, it's you know, the new capsule is pretty interesting because it's, you know, bigger than the ones that we had sent Apollo astronauts into. They've got a number of other tests that they have to do to make sure that this thing is going to be flight ready, with the goal of eventually using it to send people to the landing on the moon. So let's see. Go to the mission here. We can check out this, the Artemis 2. By the way, if you want, you can go get your name put on a disc that will be like a thumb drive that will be sent around the moon. So you can be a virtual passenger.
That's
I signed up.
That sounds how interesting. Wait, like there's already a layer of abstraction to having your name go on a thing. But to have the data of your name, technically that's the same, but somehow that feels different. I don't know. I'm curious.
Brian, don't step on my joy.
So I know. I don't want to. It's a little bit like, I mean, also the International Star Registry is pretty cool. Somebody's got to name all the stars. I'm here for it.
But that's made up. This is real. You see, that's just a for-profit enterprise. This is NASA, which is. If you go to the NASA website for Artemis 2, you can actually see a flight path animation, and they show you the flight path it's going to be taking on. It's interesting because I think we have entered that point where space has become a little bit, okay, all right. And I think even this mission, you know, Jared Isaacman did his mission and went further than anybody had gone since the NASA program. Got a little bit of attention, but I don't think anybody remembers. And now we're at a point where I think that this mission, I think people are like, oh, cool, I get it, I guess. It's not going to be until we put boots on the moon that people are going to wake up and go, holy crap, we're on the moon.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people are there all the time.
Yeah, this will get headlines. I don't know if we'll have national fixation until you see boots on the moon. But I do think that this will be kind of like an opening ceremony. It'll be a lot of crazy visuals, stuff like that. It'll be like a you know, where are the astronauts today kind of a news story. But in terms of like there being a real lock-in moment, I think it'll be boots on the ground or boots on the moon.
Do you guys, you want to hear something crazy? According to data, the crew is Reed Wiseman, Victor Glover, Christina Koch, Jeremy Hansen, ages 50 years old, 49 years old, 46 years old, and 49 years old, meaning that in their lifetime, nobody has gone to the moon. All of the astronauts in their lifetime, they will be the first people to go to the moon. Isn't that wild?
Go around the moon. That's nuts. Yeah. I mean,
to go over there, out there, however you want to measure.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's what's more remarkable is that we did it after we stopped dreaming.
never going to let Neil deGrasse Tyson live that
sorry,
one down.
Sorry, dude. You got to hold that L forever. Sorry, dude.
Hold on.
You gotta hold that L for the rest of your life. That was your take right before a space boom, the likes of which we haven't seen in our entire human species. Yeah.
Oh,
sorry, dude. You gotta, yeah, that one.
Here's what happened in the 1960s. We were at war with the Soviet Union, Cold War, and a little bit of hot war over in Southeast Asia. So we fear them. Because they put up Sputnik, which, by the way, people forget, was an emptied out casing of an intercontinental ballistic missile. And Sputnik it itself means fellow traveler, so it's all peaceful, but it was a ballistic missile hit without explosives. So that was a signal, and we freaked in America. So NASA got founded.
Anyway, he eventually says we stopped dreaming.
Yeah.
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 R.I.P.
Not
dreams.
All of us.
Yeah, that's what happens when
you know.
That's what happens when you entrust a museum operator to be your number one intellectual when it comes to space.
And, you know, worth noting, too, that Wernher von Braun, at the time Sputnik happened, he had been working with the Army Redstone Project, and they had a rocket capable of putting a satellite into space. But the U.S. government said, nope, we want our civilian agency to do it first because we want to make a point. And then the Russians did it. And they're like, God damn it. So then they basically shipped the Army rocket to NACA or whatever it was at the time so they could go do it. And it was one of these things where it was a bit of a cell phone. It changed the trajectory of everything. But yeah, I think that, you know, we've had this incredible, if you look at the actual amount of mass launched into space, and that's primarily by SpaceX, it's incredible. SLS is going to be part of a complex program, the Artemis, where you're going to first do this. This is a 10-day mission. So they're going to be orbiting the Earth and going off over to the moon and doing the free return trajectory. And for Artemis 3, which is to land people on the moon, the other component is going to be the human landing system, which is the HLS, which is something built by SpaceX. And there's a lot of things in play. Goal is to try to get that done, though, within the next 2 years. The idea that we could put boots on the ground back on the moon in 2 years is a real possibility.
That's crazy. And it just shows you, I mean, the ability to turn something like that around at the speed and at the cost that we're going to be able to do it is just, you know, we're in a different world. Like the idea of putting people on the moon before seemed like the end of a journey. And this kind of seems like the beginning.
Well, the goal now is to maintain a sustained presence and to do this. And I think one of the problems with sort of like when we try to revisit what happened, whatever, and kind of we stopped dreaming was, it was ridiculously expensive. And instead of building towards reusability and commercialization of space, we didn't do that. We went in to say, okay, we're going to have the military, we'll do their stuff. And then we're going to kind of just use space as only going to be peaceful scientific exploration, which you've got to see return on that. And as much as we can talk about Tang and Velcro and things like that, when those dollars aren't directly going back into the budget,
yeah,
it becomes sort of voodoo economics. You can just say, oh yes, it did this benefit. Maybe not. And I think that was one of the biggest turns was eventually realizing, oh, okay, maybe if we try to figure out economic reasons to be up there, then we'll really have a reason to be there, which is always the truth. It's always the case is that we need to, you know, get some benefit from being there other than just saying, oh, look at this cathedral we've built.
Yeah. Yeah.
You guys excited?
Yes. Sorry. You caught me in the middle of I was adjusting a video thing.
Well, we did stop dreaming.
That's right.
No, I mean, I'm excited. I think it's just a matter of like, we've been at a moment of perpetual excitement for what we've been able to do with rocketry, what we've been able to do to access space cheaper and easier than we ever have before. Obviously there's been a big fight amongst very entrenched interest within NASA and within the American government and this, you know, Congress for a very long time. It does appear that now we are at a point where we're a little bit more willing when it comes to big projects like this to take advantage of some of the things that have happened in space over the last decade. But You know, I guess I just want, I want to see it up there. I want to see it do things. I'm excited for it to be going on. That's what I am excited for.
Less talk, more action. Where are them verbs at?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that's the thing. Well, it's like we're in a moment right now where it's like, it's possible. So let's do it. And the idea of getting excited for getting excited is less exciting, if that makes sense.
Well, I got some more stuff for you to take a look at. I want you to look at vastspace.com.
Vastspace.com. V-A-S-T. Vastspace.com. Yep. What have we here?
They're building next generation space stations and with plans to have their first launch next year.
Next generation space stations. What can we look for in a next generation space station?
The idea is to make things that are very modular and to take what we've learned from decades of building space stations. Give an example of something. I have a friend of mine. He helped design like the racks that went into the ISS, right? And he said, yeah, we need to have these modular racks to pull them in and out. The Russians didn't do it. The Russians basically just carved them into the wood or whatever they used for the mirror, which meant that they said one of the reasons Russia decided to deorbit their space station and just let it burn up in the atmosphere was because they had a weird fungus growing or mold growing in there.
Right.
That they figured out, you know what? Maybe we don't need to keep this going. And because, you know, space is weird and whatnot. So the ISS has been probably the most expensive, you know, single human achievement in history when it comes to like a structure, but it's still an amazing success. This thing's been over for up there for 25 plus years. And it's kind of amazing to think about this. We have had people in space nonstop onboard a space station for a long time. I think we would have been further along by now. But now with the cost of putting things in space having gotten much cheaper, with primarily thanks to Elon Musk and SpaceX, now the idea of building space stations doesn't mean you have to spend hundreds of billions of dollars. These things can be done, you know, for mere tens of billions. VastSpace is what they've done is they've created a space station that can be launched on board existing rockets, like, you know, I believe the Falcon 9. And what it is you can see right here, they have a structure where they can basically continue to extend outward from a central hub. And this can be a very large space station. Basically think of an office park in space. So they have their Haven demo, Haven 1, Haven 2, and you can see, you know, when you click up there to see the different plans, if you click on to see where things are headed, and the idea is to just continually add more of these structures to it. Remember we watched the video that was the beginning of the Luc Besson movie about, the name is already...
Oh, that's right. It was the one where we saw just like generations of humans changing over time.
Yeah. Valerian in a city of 1,000-something.
Yeah.
That was a cool opening because what they did is they just showed the space station that continued to be added on to and grow bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's kind of what would be sort of cool to see. And so this is what they're doing. Vast is working on this idea of building a space station that can just be modular and continue to add these structures to it. Their goal is to replace the U.S. because we're going to need to replace the ISS soon because there are plans to either deorbit it or put it into a different shift and shift to a next generation system. So they're trying to make themselves, you know, the key partner for making that happen.
How far off are we from that's a reality that I hadn't really considered is the decommissioning of the ISS.
ISS decommission. 2030 is the plan.
Dude, 4 years away? Like mm-hmm. If a freshman in college is gonna senior year, watch that thing go away.
Yeah.
What do you think they're gonna do?
Park it into the ocean.
They're just gonna let it fall into the to Earth.
Yeah, deorbit it and plant it into that. So that is the goal. So right now you've got, you know, one of the companies that's vying for building the next generation space station is Vast Space of Haven. You have Axiom, which is actually building a power module for the space station. So they've been doing existing contracts. If you go to Axiom Space, A-X-I-O-M Space, you can see their goals, what they're planning to do. So it's going to be a very, very interesting world where we're having multiple companies that are building space station stuff that names aren't just, you know, Boeing or Lockheed.
Can I ask a super dumb question about the ISS?
Well, only if it's super dumb.
It's really dumb. So how destroyed will it be when it gets into the water? Do we have any idea how destroyed?
Not a dumb question at all. So
one might say fairly important.
Yes, super good question. So when we deorbited Skylab, that was like, I think the last major time that we took, that was at Apollo era, using Apollo era hardware, which was, we put a space station up in the 1970s. It was a pretty cool mission. That was going to look like the windmill. You know, in theory, it was just going to all disintegrate. But man, those Australians were pissed.
Yeah. Cause, yeah, because it hit the ground, right?
Parts of it did. So I think our projections are a lot better now, but this is why we're going to take it out over the ocean. So we know that there are going to be large fragments. So it's going to be an entire zone that basically it's going to try to deorbit into. And so basically pieces, chunks will rain from the sky, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess like that's my question is like, is there going to be a chunk of Space Lab or the ISS that not Space Lab, that the ISS that will like end up in a museum somewhere? Like, is there going to be some chunk of it that survives?
Yeah, like it. I don't know if you did. We talked about this before when the Apollo program launched. The first stages ended up in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, right? You know, and, you know, super, super deep, whatever, lost forever. Enter world's biggest, richest space nerd, Jeff Bezos, who launches a basically Howard Hughes level mission to recover the rocket engines and like has one proudly displayed.
Yeah.
So I think if you're inclined, yes, you could probably get pieces, but I don't think it's as cool as a Saturn V booster.
I mean, it's still going to be pretty cool, right? That thing was up in space for how long?
Yeah, it's up. It's going to be a long time. You know, we've got pieces. I think of one of the SpaceX rockets that blew up on the launch pad.
Yeah.
I would not turn down that souvenir. I'd like to put it next to my Neanderthal hand axe, which, by the way, absentmindedly, I had one of those, you know, when you get soda delivered by Amazon, there's a good chance that, you know, you're going to drop it and the Coke can is going to be deformed. And I had a deformed thing and I decided to start knock the thing back into shape. I look and I'm using this.
That's amazing.
This quarter million year old Neanderthal hand axe.
Still working, dude. I'm just like, still working. I know, still got still it good. After all these
best
years.
Purchase ever.
Oh man. So it's so amazing to see what we can what we're going to be doing in space, but it's also amazing what to see you guys can do if you support us. patreon.com/weirdthings is where you need to go if you would like to support the show. Thank you so much to everybody who does it, keeping us on the air. We greatly, greatly, greatly appreciate your support.
We can go to space if we have enough funding.
You
know,
we can do it. Come on, that's got to be a big threshold for us. Maybe that's when we end the show. We end the show when we do our final episode in space.
I want to do my short little pitch. Why space? And Scott Manley's got a new video up. It's worth checking out on YouTube. He does a lot of great space commentary, but I haven't watched it yet. But I looked at the screen grabs. It's pretty much the same. When you start doing things in a microgravity environment, things behave differently. We know antibiotics don't work the same way. We know that, you know, grow differently. Bacteria functions differently. There are all these very interesting things. And one of the things that drives science forwards is finding materials that behave in a different way. And the next generation of pharmaceuticals, things like this, might in part coming from space. The next materials that we develop might be things that come out of space. Photonics, microprocessors, all kinds of stuff. It is just this, you know, it's like discovering a new continent of things of which you can find new applications for and to make use of. You know, we forget that, you know, we didn't have the potato till we came to the New World, or things like, you know, rubber or things like this didn't happen throughout the exploration. And going into space gives us a new frontier for chemical discovery. And I think that we're going to find out that it's more than worth what we put into it to go there.
It's a good point. It's a good point. Brian, did you say that you had a story?
It was about the possible pregnancy in space.
Ah, okay. Well, there we go. There we go.
Yeah, we'll see. You know, it's always the NASA has a habit of very tightly controlling narratives around themselves. They've got, considering, because they consider themselves, you know, or they are considered in the national interest. They also do military launches, things like this. They have probably way more of a tightly knit media controlled capability than we often realize. And certain stories sometimes never make it into the news, things like this. When you talk to astronauts, you will hear things. You go like, man, this would have been front page news. And like, yep, it would have been. And it wasn't.
And it was,
you know, and it sometimes it. What's that?
I was echoing your point that it was not. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. 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 One of the things Jared Isaacman has promised coming as the new head of NASA is that he wants to be much more transparent about things. And the first big test for that was the concerns that people had about the heat shield on the Orion capsule. And, you know, there's at least, you know, one, you know, former astronaut who still says, I don't think it's safe. Others have said that it is. But Isaacman tried to be as open as possible about that. And I would say that was one of my criticisms about NASA in the past, was decisions were often made, you know, kind of in secret. And they came out and said, this was the only choice we had. And when it went wrong, and then you found out like, no, you had other options, but you, for whatever reason, decided to cover your ass. And then it kind of helped kind of create a situation where people lost a lot of faith in NASA in some regards. Mm. You know, we've lost two space shuttles. And that was way, way higher than we thought that the risk rate of it was. And it turned out there was a lot of data to say this was the space shuttle is much more risky than we thought it was. And that the causes for, you know, loss of vehicle in many cases were people said, yes, this will cause this. And that kind of got shut down. Space shuttle was one of these situations where it was a compromise. It was, the goal was to build a fully reusable vehicle, but there was a lot of technical difficulties and other challenges for that. And it kind of just said, let's just go build it and do what we can. And they built a thing that was a compromise and successfully did a lot of wonderful things. But you get crazy things. You start to dig into it and you find out that the onboard printer, the thing they use to get communications from Earth onboard the space shuttle, weighed something like 90 pounds, right? If you average the cost of what that spent, they spent to put that into space over the lifetime of the shuttle while that was used, you're talking several SpaceX Falcon 9 launches. It was, you know, tens of millions, $80 million. It was incredible how they spent it. And NASA would say, well, it was trying to redesign. It was really expensive. And it's like, well, three engineers at $60,000 a year on a 2-year timeline, you would have been able to re-engineer it and done that and saved us $90 million. But that's just not the way that NASA thought. They're like, well, we have this now. And well, then I have to go hire. I have to go do this and that. And that's one of the reasons that we were trying to move towards a different model for just, you know, procuring things for space launch, because you would find things like the tower used for the SLS rocket that was built by like Bechtel for like over $1 billion. The tower alone was built for over $1 billion. And for a fraction of that price, SpaceX built Mechazilla, you know, a highly articulated tower that was able to do all kinds of things. And so a lot of it's just not just that they're expensive, but the way they do things are expensive, and the inertia to try to do things differently is really hard. And, you know, you can cynically point that out. That's probably a feature because of just like the defense industry, the pattern of people who come out of there, the government service, and then work for contractors. Their goal is not to lower the amount of money being spent in, it's to increase it. But I'm not a cynic.
Well, so what do we think, if we're putting on our speculation hats? We've talked previously about how NASA becoming a public entity that would use private spacecraft, we likened it a bit to the post office, where it's like they're not manufacturing all of the cars that deliver the mail on there. I wonder, I guess I'm poking a little bit at the general question of how big the appetite for government-funded science is, or absent that, like we're in the middle of an inflection point where the cost to get to orbit is lower than at any point, but also the drive to shove it in the commies' face is also lower than ever.
I mean, I would say it's pretty high on both sides. In general, politically, we tend to respond to things that are visual. And so if it is cheap enough that you can do things regularly and it looks dope, people will be excited for it as much as they are excited for any kind of government expenditure. If you can create any sort of narrative around it that, you know, moves us forward, let alone advances us ahead of other international interests, it's like, sure, the eastward commies on a map are
the Chi-coms.
Yeah. Chi-coms. The USSR is gone. China's here, and China's got a rocketry program, and we're worried about a war with them too. So it's like, there's no reason why you can't advance this on multiple different ways. And to say that, look, we're doing this more and cheaper than we have before, the question then becomes, all right, well, what's our goal? So we're going to go back to the moon. That's going to be interesting because that is a thing we have not done in a while. And we'll have an appetite for building things on there. The first blank on the moon will always get our attention, especially when it's a Taco Bell. The question of where we go past that, that's, you know, exciting. People want to know. There is a primal a thirst for adventure, and I think it will be popular. That's my guess.
Yeah, and part of the motivation for Artemis's timeline is China's goal of getting on the moon by 2030. And the idea that, you know, people are like, well, we made it before. I'm like, we didn't do it this century. You know, the fact that, you know, that in the entire 21st century, we never went back to there suggests that we lost a capability or ability to do that. And I would say that, you know, we can get into, there's a discussion, say, well, how much should we be chasing these kinds of goals, things like this? But man, we got a lot of mileage out of saying we made it to the moon. We got a lot of mileage out of that. And right now, you know, you get a lot of discussions about, oh, look at robotics in China, look at their high-speed rail, you look at this. And as much as we want to sort of dismiss this as just PR, there are some very bad strategic deals being made by other countries right now because their perception of China's technological capability. You know, and I would say it's a very jagged thing, but you're seeing some people looking at like, well, maybe we should partner China. Look at all these amazing things they're doing. Some of them are amazing. Some of them are complete bullshit. And these people can't tell the difference. And I would say that there's an argument made. Like, yeah, you do it to show like, hey, listen, we can do these kinds of things. The problem is, though, as we've talked about before repeatedly, when it came to like the SLS and the artist program part, it's the way we chose to do it is just so ridiculously expensive compared to doing it the best way we can do it, which is using American commercial enterprise.
Yeah. And now that we're showing more and more ways that you can, you know, create a sustainable business by exploiting the resources of space, the more you're going to want to put stuff out there.
We've now got, you know, Blue Origin, by the way, which lost out on the HLS, system. So the program, the way that Artemis 3 works is the crew is going to go there. It's similar mission profile to what we're doing for Artemis 2. They're then going to dock with a lander vehicle. In this case, the SpaceX HLS will dock with that, and that will land on the moon and then go back up and bring them back to Orion. Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos' space company, tried to bid on that and lost and was frustrated about that, but they've actually gone back to the drawing board and redone their design because they are absolutely committed to, you know, making that happen. If you go to blueorigin.com/blue-moon, you can see their lunar lander, their latest lunar lander. And Bezos is going to put something on the moon. I am.
You're calling it.
If anything,
Jeffy kisses.
He is this committed. This is once he wants his legacy to be. He definitely wants to be able to do stuff on the moon, and he's not going to let that not happen. So it's pretty cool if you go look at what they've done there. Yeah, you can see that. He's in it for the long haul.
Yeah. I mean, as soon as he gets off the yacht in St. Barts, but you know, there's time.
Yeah. Well, he's been taking a more active role in Blue Origin. And,
he has,
and now the rockets have they've been putting people into space and the rocket engines have been, you know, flying missions. So the problem Blue Origin had, in my opinion, was he brought in a lot of people who had been working on conventional space, working in it from the old method, and realized, hey, you know what? After decades of getting, he started before SpaceX and SpaceX beat him. And then I think he finally realized that maybe hiring a bunch of the guys that were easily outcompeted wasn't the best attitude. If you go look at the different vehicles, and this is one I haven't seen before, you see the New Shepard. New Shepard is what, you know, they've been using to send people up into, you know, above the Kármán line into space. New Glenn is the rocket they're planning, which will be capable of doing, sending people around the Earth and do, you know, satellite launches. And then you have Blue Moon, which is going to be, that's their moon mission. And then you see Blue Ring, which I didn't know about.
So we were talking about profitable things to do in space. And Marion G in the chat reminded us of the, did you see this new shape that was created in microgravity?
No.
This is a platonic shape that was mathematically conceived but could not be made on planet Earth. So what they did was they 3D printed this scaffolding and used cohesion. That's pure water inside mm-hmm. of that. And it itself, just based on the laws of cohesion, it adheres mm-hmm. and creates that funky shape. And then that can have, of course, all kinds of ramifications for creating pharmaceuticals and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think we're going to see a lot of things like that. And particularly when you look at, like, you know, on the micro scale and looking at that, there's a lot of things that we just, when you remove most of the effects of gravity and you enter that in a situation, you have it for extended periods of time, you know, gosh, you know, who knows what's going to happen. And you get cellular function changes, all sorts of other things do. What happens when telomeres are naturally looser and extend more? It's just, I'm excited about that.
Yeah. You got any,
gentlemen,
you got any picks? I got one.
Go ahead.
It's taken me a little bit to get caught up on it, but boy, oh boy, you know what's pretty good still is Fallout season 2. I just hit episode 3 of season 2 where there's a fun reveal. Somebody takes off a mask and it's Macaulay Culkin, and he's really good. It's I am told that the season gets even better near the end, so I'm excited about it.
A very eclectic cast they have there.
Yep. Kumail Nanjiani plays Kumail Nanjiani. it's a bit distracting that he's just Kumail Nanjiani, but that's fine.
Don't worry, Brian. Don't worry.
Yeah.
I've enjoyed it immensely. I think this season of Fallout, I've had so much fun with it. It's just a show that goes into such random directions that are sort of delightful. As they I love shows where they explore the corners of the world and the world gets kind of weird and kind of makes sense. So.
I didn't watch anything new this week, but I do want to give a shout out to a movie that finally deserves some kind of critical recognition. And that is Sinners, which broke the record for the amount of Oscar nominations that it got, which look, there was a backlash to the movie because of the amount of Oscar nominations, but, you know, because now you're going to compare it to every great movie of all time and say, like, you know, suck it, Godfather. Here comes Sinners. And there's a lot of reasons why it did. And some of them, I think, are more critically interesting than others. But I think it was just kind of a perfect storm. There's not really, I'll put it this way. I'm happy a movie that a lot of people have seen is getting that kind of recognition, because it is mm-hmm. in a declining movie industry that does not put out as many movies, when the number one movie that everybody is talking about is a movie that has not been seen by a lot of people. then you don't get the critical mass that an award show really gives you, which is, let's talk about movies. Which movie did you like better? I like this one. I like this one. I thought this supporting performance was great. Like, that's what's fun. That's what makes the critical, the critical reaction to it, the commercial reaction to it interesting, is when it at least has been seen by X amount of people. And that's been a big frustration I've had with the Oscars, is that it winds up rewarding a lot of these movies that don't have the footprint. And so I'm happy that Sinners got it. I'm happy for Ryan Coogler. I like the movie. That deserved to be the most nominated of all time. You know, look, that's what happens.
Heat it, Lincoln.
I'll defend it in a sense. Like, I think that, yeah, it is a movie that just, you know, you talk about quadrants, just a lot of people liked it from a lot of different points of view. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Coogler was able to get his message across, which a lot of people are like, okay, I still enjoyed the movie, you know, and really enjoyed the movie. Really thought there was great stuff in there. Does Avatar deserve to be the highest grossing movie of all time? It is. And it is because it hits enough people go, hey, I really like this.
Yeah.
And and there's a lot of times we forget that, like, the movie, my favorite movie, you know, my third favorite movie might be, if everybody else says it's everybody else's third favorite movie, then that's really what it takes to be everybody, the number one movie. Like, yeah. Remember when Shawshank Redemption was the number one movie on IMDb, yeah. Right? I don't think Shawshank Redemption was anybody's favorite movie. It was in our top movies, but it was enough top movies for enough people for it to be the number one movie on IMDb. And, well, and I think that, I feel that, yeah.
Oh, I always think of this as the Finding Nemo situation, where it's like Finding Nemo and Fight Club were both out at the same time. I think one of them was a more interesting artistic movie than the other. However, one was more generally pleasant than the other, and as a result had a 99% Rotten Tomatoes score versus the upon launch 65% Rotten Tomatoes score.
It was not out at the same time.
Yeah.
Which one? Was it Finding? It was
Finding Nemo was out in 2003. Fight Club was out in 99.
At that time, those were the relative scores. That's when I noticed the difference between the two.
Gotcha.
Yeah, they weren't out at the same time. That's correct.
Well, Toy Story 2 was out at the same time as Fight Club.
Yeah.
That was a part of that 1999 year. Great year. Look, I love Sinners. I mean, Sinners is like, two of my favorite movies of all time are From Dusk Till Dawn and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And yeah. Sinners is in many ways a mashup of those two movies. I think the cast is really likable. I'm glad that Delroy Lindo got recognition. I think he's a really, really fun part of that movie. I am excited. Yeah, I think it's, and also it's like that versus One Battle After Another is, an interesting thing. Oh crap, I did see something.
Hmm.
Yeah, I didn't like Knives Out 3. Anyway, that's it. That's my review.
when James Bond looks right down the camera and said, I don't listen to internet commenters.
Well, yeah, spoiler alert for the final 5 minutes of Knives Out 3. But look, Rian Johnson. Baby, what are you doing, man? Look, like you should be in this. Like Paul Thomas Anderson and Ryan Coogler are like contemporaries of you. Get your head in the game, man. What is going on?
I heard all this sort of critical backlash against Starfleet Academy and I want to make it clear, too, like I heard that about She-Hulk and I said, you know what? I'm going to go watch She-Hulk myself. And other than the terrible last episode, I enjoyed She-Hulk.
Yeah,
there was, you know, the couple dumb scenes in there, really, really dumb. I actually enjoyed it. I thought it was clever. You know, the Agatha Harkness, I actually enjoyed that. I thought the Agatha, I liked it. And so I'm a person that, like, you know, I don't, you know, listen, I can. Something can come from some point of the world or something, spectrum or whatever. I don't necessarily understand. If it's entertaining, I'm entertained. I'm happy, you know? So I'm like, well, let me watch this Starfleet Academy.
Yeah.
Because there were episodes of Strange New Worlds they liked. A lot of people don't like Lower Decks. I liked Lower Decks. I think I kind of fell out of Lower Decks. It felt repetitive, but I enjoyed a lot of Lower Decks. So I like some of the episodes of Strange New World. Then it just got to be the same thing that Discovery was, and I just couldn't keep watching it. But, man,
origami chicken,
Starfleet. Yeah. Starfleet. You know, ever since I was a kid, they talked about trying to do that an IP based around Starfleet Academy, and I was excited about the idea. When I was a kid dreaming about that idea, this was not my dream. This was not what I wanted. And it was it was interesting because the creators were like, yeah, we wanted to create, like, we loved about, you know, what would have Harry Potter was all the interesting teachers. I'm like, yeah, you should have interesting teachers instead of people who scream and yell and you think they're authoritative and all this. And, you know, a crazy cat lady captain, you know, like, I'm like, this is, I don't know who this is for. I'm like, I'm listen, haters, I'm going to give this a chance. And I'm like, oh man, the haters were right. So
honestly, great call by the haters.
I went back and watched Dune 2 and I'm like, man, this is great. And then I watched Dune 2 and I'm like, what am I doing? You know what? I'm going to go watch Dune 1, you know? Yeah. And so Dune 2, great. Really, really great. When I watched the first Dune, you know, when you know the story and you're watching the theater, there's a little clock in your head and you're looking at how long you've been in the theater and you're looking at sections of the book. And first time watching Dune, I'm feeling a little anxiety because I'm like, we haven't moved to the point where we need to move to if we're going to get the full story. And they did that bait and switch on us. And I don't blame Danny Villeneuve. I blame the freaking Legendary. Was they didn't tell us it was part one.
Yeah.
They didn't tell us that.
They just said it was Dune.
They're too cowardly to give a budget to do Dune 2 and to cast for Dune 2 so you could have Christopher Walken and Austin Butler in Dune 1. They said, you know, we're not going to do that. We'll see how Dune 1 does. And Dune 1 does good enough to do a Dune 2. And then now he's like, great, I've got to introduce these characters. Should have been there. Anyhow, when I watched Dune 1, I got to the end of it. My wife's like, what'd you think? I said, they do Dune 2. I'm going to watch these things side by side, then I'll judge. Because then I get to see the movie Danny Villeneuve wanted to make.
Yeah.
And it's a great movie. Great movie.
And did you feel like you got again when he's like, watch for Dune 3?
Different book. Yeah. Different book.
Yeah.
It's fine. That we get, you know, and probably it's probably going to mix Children of Dune and Dune Messiah. I'm excited. No, that's fine. Like, I just needed to see the full Dune story from the first book, which is like one of the greatest books ever written. And I got that. Now that we get a Dune 3.
Let's go.
Yes.
Let's go.
Did you watch any of you try to watch Dune Prophecy?
Oh, the HBO show?
Yeah. So there's this strategy that HBO wanted to lean into, which was, and Disney to an extent too, it's like, if we have an IP, we can do theatrical and we can also we can do streaming, right? We can do that. And the problem is that on surface, it seems like a great idea, but normally it just completely fails because, like, one, you look how long it took HBO to create a TV show based around another Game of Thrones TV show, right? The number of pilots they did, everything else like this you did. Oh, by the way, I saw the new one, Night of the Seven Kingdoms or whatever like that. Other than one horrific, terrible scene that made me want to shut it off because they're trying to prove to how hard they are their own show. Enjoyed it. Might be probably too slow moving for me. I don't know if I'll make it through the season. But
Can I ask you this? This is what my sense of Night of the Seven Kingdoms, having read, I think Variety did a big thing with George R. R. Martin. But Night of the Seven Kingdoms, my sense of it is, did you like Game of Thrones when it was dirty people talking in tents? Because if you liked that part, this is a whole show built around people that are unwashed and they're talking to each other in tents. And at some point, someone's probably going to pull a knife and do something dastardly.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll make it past the second or third episode because my wife watches this. She couldn't understand a single thing they're saying. I'm like, yeah, I don't even know what the hell they're saying. I enjoyed it enough. There was a scene there that you'll have to see, and you'd be like, why? I'm like, why? Like, I was ready to turn it off at that point because it was just so dumb and just so it was so trying to break the fourth wall in a way that wasn't intended, you know? I'll give it a shot. I'm not excited about it. But I'd say that's part of the problem with kind of developing IP. It's like Dune Prophecy, that they were going to try to take, you know, the earlier Dune books, you know, the later written books by Kevin J. Anderson and Brian Herbert, and try to do a story about the formation of the houses and stuff. Great, rich thing. And then you just looked at, by the time Denis Villeneuve had kind of actually backed out of that, and you looked at the trajectory that went, I got nervous. And then the show comes out and you're like, the Bene Gesserit are a bunch of, like, you know, whiny, complaining, not at all, you know, fearsome planners who just, like, oh, this is like, you know, Real Wives of, Eric Keane or something like this. This is not good. You know, it's like, I don't know if you guys read the books or got what made them cool and whatever. And so I think we stopped second episode in. Like, oh, this is terrible. And that's been the one bright light, though, for HBO was Penguin.
Yeah.
You know, that was, did you see that yet, Justin?
We didn't get to the finale, actually, but everything that we saw was great. We really liked it. And that's a case of overcasting a character that wasn't that big of a character in the first Batman that you can wrap an entire. I mean, like, you have a star. You have a star that can carry. If you've got a good story there, he's going to give you what you need.
Well, that was the thing.
I was going to say, and not for nothing. It's Colin Farrell in a fat suit. But like Josie watched three episodes before she encountered a photo of him, you know, as a handsome actor. And she's like, what? And so like, obviously, to somebody who had no baggage going into it, the performance really played.
He's a good actor.
Yeah,
he's really good. He is a star.
Well, Doom Prophecy has really good actors. Like Mark Strong and others. You look at the list of, you're like, oh, this, but you're like, it's, part of the problem is like it's hard because there are showrunners that get into that do really good pitches in the meeting to the networks about how much they love the property, whatever. And they're like, we love these people. They're going to be great with it. And then you get things like Rings of Power. And you're like, oh my God, like you said the things to get yourself into the room. Then you're like, yes, but let's improve upon this Tolkien thing.
Yeah.
You know, let me this Frank Herbert had some ideas, but let me tell the story I'm here to tell you. And, you know, then you get like Disney Plus Doctor Who. So anyhow.
Yeah.
Anything else, gentlemen?
So you liked Starfleet Academy?
Man. Let's see what happens next. I will tell you this. I did the math, and I think that more people spent time looking at and reading this story about William Shatner eating cereal while in traffic than actually watched the premiere episode of Starfleet Academy. And if you said, do I want to watch another episode of that? Or just watch William Shatner eating cereal in traffic? Shatner all the way.
Yeah.
It's been weird. Pew.